KPCW News Time is 8:06. This is Roger Goldman. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. Let's see what's going on with the weather this weekend. On the phone, we have Cedric Haynes with ABC4 Weather Center.
Yes, good afternoon, or good morning, I should say, out there. Yeah, we've got some chilly weather out there to kick off the day, but it's a sunshine. And as we go throughout this afternoon for your Friday, we're looking at some pretty nice weather. Plenty of sunshine is expected across the area. For Park City, we're looking at those highs climbing into the low 70s. The Heber Valley will likely get into the upper 70s to around 80 degrees, but it's still going to be a very nice day overall. There is a very slight chance of an isolated sprinkle by the time we get towards this evening, but I think for the most part, we stay dry here across most of northern Utah as we go throughout your Friday afternoon and Friday evening. And again, should be a nice way to kick off the upcoming weekend. Now, as we go into your weekend, we will start to see a few more clouds on the increase. Your Saturday will feature partly cloudy skies, and by Saturday afternoon, we will introduce a slightly better chance of a few isolated showers and storms. Now, the activity will be coming up from the south, so a little backwards from what we usually see, but a few of those isolated storms could sneak in, especially as you get after the lunchtime hour across both Park City and into the Heber Valley. High temperatures around Park City will climb into the lower 70s, and highs in the Heber Valley will climb into the mid-70s, and of course, we'll start the day with temperatures right around 40 degrees. Now, the good news is the rain chance doesn't stick around very long. I think by Saturday night, any rain chances will be quickly moving off towards the east, and we'll be seeing improving weather conditions out there with plenty of sunshine returning as we go into your Sunday, and those temperatures will be back into the cool side. So we're talking 30s again for the Heber Valley and Park City as we kick off your Sunday morning, and high temperatures on Sunday likely only in the upper 60s in Park City and highs only in the mid-70s across the Heber Valley. Now, also keep in mind, of course, the autumnal equinox occurs on Sunday, of course, what we call official start of fall, at least on the calendar. So it will definitely go back to feeling and looking like fall with more sunshine and that crisp air that's going to be in place across the area, and also primarily dry conditions. Now, as we go into next week, we're looking at partly cloudy skies and temperatures for the most part staying in the 60s to low 70s for highs in Park City, and we'll start to warm into the low to mid and eventually upper 70s for the Heber Valley, but lots of sunshine and primarily dry weather looks to take fold for the first week of fall. So we've got a little hiccup to get through for us, especially for our Saturday afternoon with a chance of a few isolated showers and storms. Otherwise, the next 7 days looking very fall-like and feeling very fall-like with those pleasant weather conditions.
Thank you, Cedric, and have a good weekend.
You too. Thank you.
Coming up, we'll be speaking with Don Miller of Orchestra Esperanza, a new organization that's going to be formed to pair professional musicians with students. Then we'll be joined by Heber City Police Sergeant Josh Weischer. He's going to be talking about the upcoming Police Kids Academy. We're going to finish our hour by speaking with Leslie Barkas, the executive director of Nuzzles & Company. We're going to be joined with weather in a few minutes, but first let's do a little bit of local news. The youngsters who flocked to Park City to ski the Wasatch in the 1970s are senior citizens now, and they're looking to bring back the good old days at next month's 70s reunion. KPCW's Leslie Thatcher has more.
The 1970s were a transformational period in Park City's history. At that time, we were either a former miner or a skier. There were a lot of hippies in town, too. By then, most of the area's mines had closed, but at Park City Ski Resort, the chairlifts were spinning. With the city struggling financially, many Main Street buildings were boarded up and snow was piled high on both sides of the street. But it was also a time when you could ski powder runs till noon, buy a Main Street building for back taxes, and hop between watering holes from the Hula Bowl to the Cozy, the Alamo to Solid Muldoon. Reunion organizer Sandy Kinter hopes to recreate the joyous atmosphere of the 70s and says former residents are coming from as far away as Connecticut and Hawaii to celebrate. More than 230 people have RSVP'd already.
I know there's a lot more out in the eaves waiting to see who's coming. It's been so long since everybody got together, and with all these memorials going on lately, it was the discussion that we should get together for a joyous occasion, and the plan was hatched.
The reunion will be held Saturday, October 12th from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the No Name on Main Street. A $10 reservation fee is being collected to guarantee people will show up. If there are more than 300 reservations, Kinter says the business owner will close for a private party. For those who may have arrived in town a bit later than the 70s, she says you're welcome to join, although there is a caveat.
Well, if you want to hang out with all of us old farts, and you did back in the day, please do come.
This is the same day as Shotski on Main Street, so she suggests arriving early and walk, bike, or take a bus to get to Old Town. For those who may need assistance, there'll be a drop-off area near the post office. Former Park City Mayor Dana Williams' parents had a Treasure Mountain Inn condo and brought the family to Utah during the summer starting in the mid-60s. His parents moved here full-time in 1978 and planned to open a bar on Main Street when the bartender unexpectedly died.
I was in college in San Luis Obispo, and my dad called and he said, "Can you drive out and open this bar tomorrow?" I drove all night, and we opened the bar, and, you know, and we did things like we ran tabs for people, which I still have the Rolodex from 1980. And there's a lot of you in town that with interest owe me a hell of a lot of money. But I think we had $18,000 in IOUs when we closed the bar. You know, interesting, kinder, gentler nation, certainly back then. And we really had no summer business. So we were all kind of broke and unemployed and happy.
To RSVP for the event, call Sandy at 808-634-7848. She needs a headcount by September 30th so the owner can ensure he has enough staff on hand. Leslie Thatcher, KPCW News.
The Snow Creek shopping area in the center of Park City plans to add dozens of parking spots and electric vehicle chargers. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports.
Snow Creek is home to the Market at Park City and one of the highest grossing liquor stores in the state, along with several restaurants and businesses. Park City is set to approve the property owner's request to add 42 parking spaces, bringing the shopping center's total parking to 364 spots. The owner also intends to add 12 Rivian fast-charging electric vehicle stations. The chargers will be for public use and are not limited to Rivian vehicles. One charging station will be designed to fit vehicles with trailers. These will be the first electric vehicle charging stations at Snow Creek. Kent Gibson, who manages the property for Capstone Property Management, said they don't have a clear timeline for construction, but hope to complete the improvements in the next few months. According to the online database Charge Hub, Park City and the Snyderville Basin have 126 charging stations, about a third of which are free to use. Charge Hub lists Salt Lake City, Draper, and Lehigh as the only Utah cities with more stations. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Orchestra Esperanza is a new entity that will pair professional and student musicians. Here to tell us about it is Don Miller. Good morning, Don. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. How are you?
Excellent. So, tell us a little bit about the concept of Orchestra Esperanza and how it came into existence.
Well, how it came into existence is essentially I was trying to figure out a way to integrate students in this area on the Wasatch Back and have them get an experience that was unique to this area, or for that matter, unique to everywhere. And I thought of a way to do that would be having mentors of professional musicians working with students on a long-term basis. So we came up with the idea of having three rehearsals for it, which is a short amount of time. That's very professional to do that, instead of the usual 8 weeks or whatever it is for other organizations. So we're going to have three rehearsals and then a concert, and right now we're scheduled for two concerts, and that'll give the students an opportunity to find out what it's like to be a professional musician, and also the professional musicians will have an opportunity to spend a short amount of time preparing music and then working with our students through sectionals, maybe through some private lessons and the like. So we're hoping to do this starting in November, actually, for our first concert. And then after that, we'll see what happens. We're looking forward to at least having four concerts per year.
And how large an organization do you anticipate putting together? How many musicians?
Well, right now we're looking at just string musicians. Later on, we'll add some winds and brass with it. And the reason we're starting with just string musicians is we have a real opportunity with a small group to be successful. We right now we're looking at anywhere between 8 to 12 first violins, and then 8 to 12 second violins, then 2 to 4 viola performers, as well as 4. Cellist, maybe six, and at least two basses, string bass, double basses there. And from that, we can make a very nice chamber orchestra. We have some really nice literature selected for it, including a sinfonia from the composer Felix Mendelssohn, and also a newer composition, October by Eric Whitaker, who's kind of a local boy, local as far as Nevada anyway, that's where he's from, and he's had wonderful success as a composer of choral works and orchestra works and wind ensemble works and just on and on. He's very gifted in his endeavors.
And again, the model is a little bit unique, it sounds like, where you're going to pair professional musicians with students. In the first violin section, for example, how many professionals would you anticipate being in there?
Right now, we're looking at one professional per three students. Mm-hmm. And that works out to be a very good section, so to speak, where there's going to be a lot of interaction. Later, as we get more established, we would like to have one professional with two musicians, and then a wonderful, great goal is to have one-on-one when we do that. And that'll, you know, of course, we know that that's going to take some time as we build and develop. So we're starting out with something we feel like we'll be successful with, yet we also have some big dreams for down the road.
I suspect you've probably done some work to line up your professional musicians already. Is that true?
Yes, that is.
Okay. And then where will you get your students?
The students are coming from the Park City School District. We're looking at some from the Heber City also, and also Camas. We already have some people signed up for the auditions from those areas. We're also looking for homeschool students. We even have some going all the way into Evanston, Wyoming, that'll be coming in for it. So we're looking for everything to happen on this side of the Wasatch. It's a concept that we're hoping to spread around other parts of the world also. Right now, since we're doing this grand experiment, we're trying to figure out what we're doing right and what we're doing not necessarily wrong, but what we need to do to make it right, or so to speak. So, and the professional musicians will mainly be coming from the Salt Lake Valley. We have some very fine professional musicians on this side of the mountains also that'll be a part of it, and lots of enthusiasm from the teachers as well. And that's exactly what we want, is enthusiastic teachers, and we want teachers that are musicians, and we want musicians that are teachers.
And are you recruiting? Are you recruiting through the school systems? How are you reaching out to find these students to audition?
I am recruiting through the schools. I've talked with Eva Marble and visited with her orchestra many times. Eva Marble is the string instructor here in Park City, orchestra director, and I've worked with some folks in the Heber City also. We're looking for homeschool students as well, and we're just putting the word out, and we have a website set up that is quite direct. It's an opportunity to submit your auditions. We have a list of audition material for it, so we can have a consistent idea of the level
of
players.
You're going to make them play the same thing.
Right. And then we'll have, then from that we'll listen to the videos or tapes, whichever they send in. It's totally up to them. And then we'll make our selections from there. And that'll give us an idea for the level of music that we need to perform for these first few concerts.
And we talked a little bit about the professionals. Who are they? I mean, what is the sort of profile of the typical professional you've been able to engage?
Well, the profile of the professional is, first of all, a teacher, mm-hmm. a teacher of some kind, somebody that has private students, so we can help understand what their connection is to making music with students. And then we're looking at at the level of performer that we have and the opportunity, what kind of opportunity they have to make it here for those rehearsals.
Okay. And we talked a little bit about the kinds of work you're going to be performing in this first concert. What is your vision for the sort of range of works that you would hope to be able to perform with the orchestra as you go forward?
What we're looking at now, like I said, is starting off with string works. Then we would like to perform some music that is pretty much what we would call the all-state level, which is a youth orchestra level. So we're looking at starting with the chamber orchestra, then adding pairs of winds like flutes and oboes and clarinets as things move on. And then as we get larger string sections, we would be looking at full orchestra works, like some of the romantic works and the like. That is, like I said, a long-term goal. That would require different facilities for us. That would require a lot of dedication from not only the students, but through board of directors and other volunteers.
And let's talk about facilities. Where do you anticipate being able to do these performances and in these rehearsals?
We're doing the rehearsals and the performances in the same place. I'm working with the Episcopal Church that's next to the conservatory area up there on Silver Springs Drive. Working with them, that's not set in stone yet, but feel very confident about what's taking place there. It's a wonderful place to perform. It's terrific, and it's about the right size for what we want to do. Something else that is important for us is to not make it something where 2,000 people are looking at the little black dots on the stage. We're looking at having something almost interactive, I would say. I want the audience to have an opportunity to see the musicians work. I think that's just as important as hearing the musicians work, because it's a full experience, a full sensory experience. Hearing, then also the visual of what's taking place there, and it's there's nothing like an experience watching the energy come from the musicians as they are so intense in their work and so very much focused in that, and seeing the rosin fly off the bow and those kinds of things.
So running an organization like this certainly takes organizational skills, but it also takes some money. Have you formed a not-for-profit? How does it structure from a financial perspective?
Yes, we have a 501c3. We have a nonprofit. We have a board of directors, which is required, of course, with a 501c3. We have some volunteers that are interested in helping with anything from, I'm calling it logistics, like moving chairs around and those kinds of things, getting set up for rehearsals, that kind of stuff. So we are a nonprofit, and whenever we, of course, people are paying tuition for this, and it goes, of course, in the nonprofit, so we can build up a base of funds, and then also we're looking at some donations from some businesses, as well as some donations maybe from individuals and foundations throughout the area.
So you mentioned tuition. What does it cost? What will it cost for a student to participate in the program?
Well, the full four concert series is $1,000 mm-hmm. that we're doing. Right now, so that, of course, equals the $250 per concert. We are hoping for commitment for all four of those concerts, because that'll help us make the ensemble much more stable, and that's what we're looking at doing right now.
Are you offering any scholarships, or is that pretty rigid?
We will have some scholarships available for it, and that's on an as-need basis. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily an academic or talent scholarship there. It's on an as-need basis, and we're definitely open to that, and we have some funds available for those kinds of scholarships.
So anyone should apply, even if they can't meet the
financial. Absolutely, anyone should apply, and it'll, be, of course, be confidential, and if somebody has some opportunity to make some to pay tuition for other people, we're open to that and accepting that as well.
And will the professionals receive any compensation for their participation?
Right, yes, they are receiving compensation because they are professionals.
Sure.
Yeah, and we are going to set up a situation where we, of course, pay them, and if they wish to donate part of their salary back, that would be fine. One of the things we're wanting to make it for the professionals is a terrific experience. There's three things that professionals like with their performance. They like good music, good hang, we call it, which is good friends, and then good pay. And if you have two of those with you, then you're set.
And you left off the fourth one. They like the applause.
Oh, yes, they do. They do. They like, yeah, they like the affirmation, so to speak.
Okay, let's go over the calendar once again. What are the four dates? Obviously, the four dates of the upcoming concerts?
Yeah, the dates of the upcoming concerts are in November. We'll have a concert on November 24th, and it's on Saturday. And we've set up the scenario where we're going to have two performances. We'll have one in the afternoon at 3 p.m., and then one at 7 p.m., in the evening, so we can have an opportunity to bring families at 3 o'clock, and then later on in the evening, other people that would arrive. Our rehearsals start on November 12th. That's a Tuesday, and then we have one November 14th, which is a Thursday, and then our dress rehearsal is November 16th. November 16th, and then move on from there. We'll have three rehearsals, and we'll do that for the other ones that are happening in January, another one in March, similar to that, and another one at the end of April, first part of May. So that's how we're getting our four concerts in. We've done the best job we possibly can with avoiding the concerts with and other activities with Park City High School.
As a mediocre violinist some 60 years ago in a film orchestra and a youth orchestra, I am impressed with the notion of these kids being able to get ready to do a performance with only three rehearsals. Will they be getting the music in advance?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, so they will have rehearsed themselves before we come up to these formal rehearsals.
Yeah, we're setting it up where we want the students to practice, rehearse, develop their skills individually. But that's so when we have the group to get together, we're rehearsing the orchestra as opposed to working out notes somewhat. We know it's not going to be perfect when we come in, but if there's some kind of good preparation for it, we should be we should be in very good shape for those three rehearsals.
Okay. And how can our listeners learn more about Esperanza? Is there a website they can go to?
Oh, absolutely. There's an Orchestra Esperanza. That's the orchestra. And then Esperanza, E-S-P-E-R-A-N-Z-A. And it's Orchestra Esperanza, OrchestraEsperanza.com is what it is. And we have a website with all the information on there.
How'd you choose the name?
I'm a positive person, and I know that there's a lot of things happening in the world, and there always has been. And I want the young people to have hope. Esperanza is a terrific word to help develop an understanding of peace and hope. And that's what I want the students, for that matter, everybody, but in particular, the students to gather from this musical experience.
Okay, anything else you want to touch on before we go?
No, I sure don't. This has been wonderful. I appreciate the questions. They've been very thorough, and we're looking forward to having some great performances.
Thanks, Don. Midway residents shared a range of opinions Tuesday about a proposed $5 million open space bond. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports.
In August, Midway City Council voted to put a proposition on the ballot for what could be the town's second open space bond. If voters pass the bond, they'll see an added property tax for the next 21 years. For a home worth just under $500,000, the tax increase would be about $40 per year. A business worth the same amount would pay an additional $73 per year. At a public hearing Tuesday, resident Gail Kilgore said she inherited a 56-acre Snyderville Basin farm from her father and knows how difficult it can be to keep farmland undeveloped.
We're seeing it happen here, the impacts of the developers and the increase of the taxes make it no longer sustainable for the families and community who made the community, in my opinion.
She asked Midway City Council members to come up with ways to preserve open space that didn't require raising taxes more. She says she cares about conservation, but the cost of living is becoming prohibitively expensive. Kilgore says she doesn't want to see Wasatch County towns lose their identities and their original residents amid all the new development.
Honestly, Park Cities became a place for the rich and famous, not the common people like us. And I know you talk about it's a little here, it's a little there. There takes lots of taxes to operate a community, as you all know. Every little here and there adds up for the common people not to be able to afford to live here anymore.
She asked the city to consider using resort tax dollars or impact fees to pay for open space rather than taxes. Mayor Celeste Johnson said she understood Kilgore's concerns and will consider her ideas, but state law limits how open space can be funded. She also mentioned some Midway residents are interested in setting up a fund to cover the open space tax for locals with fixed or low incomes.
I think we've got folks in our community that would like to help those for whom this is a hardship.
Brad Weiniger is a member of Preserve Midway, a nonprofit focused on the town's open space and heritage. He says the last open space bond was leveraged to preserve 400 acres and almost $200 million worth of land. He says when people learn how open space bonds are used, many say it's worth the extra expense.
One anecdotal conversation I had with a woman here in town, and when she thought it through, she thought, you know, if that's what it cost me to be able to preserve some of this open space and future open spaces, count me in. I'll work overtime to earn enough to pay enough for that incremental taxes.
Midway residents will put the proposed $5 million open space bond to a vote on Election Day, November 5th. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
The Heber Police Department will be offering a fun program for kids this Saturday. On the phone to tell us about it is Heber Police Sergeant Josh Weischer. Good morning, Josh. Sergeant, nice. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit. What is the Kids Police Academy program?
So throughout the years, we've had a police academy at the police department to involve kids in the community, usually ages between 10 and 14. It's a fun event for about 4 hours. Kids sign up prior to the event and participate in police activities at the police department. We have things like shooting some sim rounds at targets, conducting traffic stops, gathering evidence, and then physical fitness activities in our gym. We usually have a bunch of officers here in different uniforms to kind of show them what we look like while we are on duty, and then take them around for about 4 hours while we show them how to be a cop. Once we're done with that, they get a graduation certificate, a T-shirt, a donut, and then we kick them back to their kids, to their families full of sugar.
I like the donut. What's a sim round?
A sim round is like a paintball round for a handgun. Mm-hmm. We use it in sim munitions or training. It's just something that we can use. It's obviously not live rounds. You get the full effect of shooting a handgun without the loud bang, but the handgun will go through a racking on its own. So it's kind of a fun way of demonstrating what a handgun will do when you're shooting it. But it's just a paintball round.
And I assume that part of what you do during that is to talk to the kids a little bit about gun safety.
Yeah, there's definitely gun safety involved. They have a whole, the shooting is probably 2, maybe 5 rounds.
Right.
But most of it is all about gun safety, how you handle and use a weapon, and then, you know, what instances officers would use a handgun and stuff like that.
And do you sort of take them through what a traffic stop or a police stop looks like and, you know, the process you guys go through when you're doing that?
Yeah, we definitely have them get in the car. They get to press all the buttons, turn on all the lights, honk all the horns, and then get out and conduct a traffic stop. We'll usually have one of our officers be the suspect in the interaction, and they get to put the handcuffs on them and put them back at the cage. It's a lot of fun for them to be in those cars. That's probably one of the funner parts.
Yeah, I'm concerned that some of our listeners are going to want to do this, even though they're far older than 14. I know that I would. So we did the traffic stop. Do you do anything? Do you explain what happens during something like a chase?
Usually we do. We have our physical fitness portion where we'll go into the gym and we'll talk about, you know, maintaining our fitness. Sometimes we'll get them out into the back and we'll get out our speed radar and see how fast they can run compared to that. But something along the lines of, like, if we get in a foot pursuit or have to jump a fence, this is the kind of activity that you would do as a police officer. And so we let them kind of experience that a little bit.
Okay. About how many kids do you get to sign up for this, and is it already full?
We usually get, we were planning for 50 kids, if we could get that many. I think we're at the 27, maybe 30 mark at this point. We've closed it off because we have to get some preparation done. It was closed by the 16th,
okay.
So we're full on kids at this point. But we can get up to 6 or 50, just depending on who signs up.
Okay. And is this, even though it's too late to sign up, was this restricted to Heber City residents, or was it open to other residents of the area?
We advertise it for the Heber City residents. I don't think we would turn down anybody that showed up or at least signed up. But we usually advertise it in the schools and then on our Facebook page.
Okay. Let me turn to another topic if I could, unless there's anything else you want to add on this topic.
No, we'll just have some posts and stuff for Saturday when we get it going this Saturday, and you'll see more about it.
Good. Now, you gave a presentation to the City Council on code enforcement, and a couple items stood out to me. The first one I wanted to ask you about is, how significant a challenge do short-term rentals present from a code perspective?
Well, for the short-term rental challenge that we have is that we are just trying to implement enforcement in our community. We have a short-term rental a code that kind of dictates or tells us what can and can't happen, but we haven't really set it up for enforcement from code enforcement. Our code enforcement really only started about a year ago, where we had a full-time officer that was in charge of it. And so with that, we're just kind of seeing what is enforceable, what's not, and then requesting council and the city to change it. Our SDRs have issues sometimes. I would say there's probably 3 properties that we have issues with, but most of them are compliant. The issues that we tend to have is over occupancy of too many people staying at the house, possibly a party house, where it, you know, could cause sound and loud music after the music hours, and then parking issues that come up from that.
Wow. So really only 3 are giving you consistent problems. Is this one of those interactive processes where you have to take the code and figure out how to have a consistent and effective enforcement procedure?
Yeah, with learning what's happening and what issues that we are coming across, we're going to want to basically go a little bit more in the future and think of the big picture of what we want to enforce in the future. So not just simply, okay, these are the issues we're having now, more of what are the issues are we going to have in the future and how can we prevent that from happening so we don't get to the point where we're at now where we have violations and there's not a whole lot we can do about it. currently. I know that we are implementing a code that will probably get voted on the next city council so that we can go ahead and enforce it, and then they're going to process more and get into the nitty-gritty of trying to enforce more code enforcement or enforce more on the short-term rental properties.
Can you take it down a level? Is what you're saying is that there isn't really, is there a legal mechanism that's missing for you to be able to enforce the code? Is that the problem?
Well, more like the what is illegal and what is not.
Better definition.
Is hard. It just needs to be separated. And the way that we would decide, okay, you're at the capacity limit or very clear defined, you're at capacity limit. It's hard when if the state statute says that you're allowed to park somewhere and then the city is saying you're not allowed to park somewhere. As an officer, it's hard to be like, oh, yeah, I'm going to enforce the city code and not the state code or something to that effect. So we just need more, just a better code or a better consequences in those codes so that we can issue the citations or corrections or something along those lines.
So it's really a matter of trying to develop clearer guidance. And it's sort of it sounds like it's an evolutionary process that's underway.
For sure. We have a great community so that a lot of people would want to stay here for a short term and just rent out a house or so for whatever activity they're doing while we're up here. And we'd love to have that. We just need it to be reasonable. And we have people that live here and live the neighbors, and they're more concerned with what's going on. If we have party houses or people that come from out of town and illegal activity or anything like that, they don't want. And that's a different matter. We'll definitely be able to handle that if that comes across. Our biggest method that we can handle these is we really need the citizens to call in and let us know, because most of the time we don't know about it until we get a complaint or something that comes across our desk. So, and it really needs to be in the moment, not something that's like 2 weeks later, hey, by the way, they were doing something in the past. So,
you mentioned parking, and I wanted to sort of turn to the kinds of problems that the popular Marketplace on Main program creates.
Yeah, so parking is it's an issue. Obviously, we have the Marketplace on Main, and it's a park that's right in the middle of our city. And then around our city, or around that area, is neighborhood. And so with not having a large parking lot nearby or anything like that, they've created the Main Street on-street parking that doesn't have a pay to park or anything like that. But most people like to park closer to the event, and they don't want to walk or anything along those lines. So what we end up having is people parking illegally or parking too close to the intersection, parking in front of fire hydrants, in front of people's driveways, on their driveways, and it just causes an issue. So we're working on that. I mean, the best thing we could do is get clear curb and gutter in that area. We don't have curb and gutter there, which is nice. It just kind of brings us back to Old Town Hebrew, but without the clear red marking and no parking locations, it doesn't deter people from parking there. So we end up issuing citations and stuff like that in those situations.
So it sounds like some of this might be reasonably straightforward to deal with, such as just, you know, doing some painting on those curbs. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, if there are curbs.
If there are curbs.
Yeah, there's one of the issues that we have as parking enforcement for code enforcement is a lot of our curbs, there's no curbs in the middle of town. There's no sidewalk or anything like that. It's just asphalt and then dirt on the side of the road. So it becomes an issue. Most people don't really look at signs or anything if we put it up. The red curb, it's pretty universal. Everyone sees a red curb and knows you can't park there. And if we were to have that, I think it would, 99% of the problem would be solved. And those other 1% that park in those areas, we'd just ticket, and it would, hopefully that consequence would solve it as well.
Do you think the fines are at an adequate level to create the deterrence for problem parking, or is that something that you think we should be considering increasing those?
I think if we solve the issue of curb and gutter and get the red zones, the fine is currently at $50 for a parking fine. So it's not that high. But if you were to increase it, I mean, obviously an increased fine will possibly help. And maybe if we could put signage saying it's a $150 fine or something along those lines for illegal parking, maybe that would deter people. But I don't know. We'll see.
But before we go, I read through your PowerPoint, and one of the things that you mentioned was this, that there was a significant issue regarding theft of water. And I was trying to figure out what that was and how someone would do that.
So a lot of it has to do with new construction. When they're, subcontractors coming in, they'll hook up to a water without having a meter next to it. We had it at a couple locations where just the subcontractor comes in, they need water for whatever reason, their concrete or whatever they're doing, and they just hook up a hose to a fire hydrant or to the water hose or something along those lines without a meter. So it's hard for us as code enforcement to know about those things because that's definitely happening and maybe they unhook it and we don't see it. I know that our Public Works is working on having a better response and understanding on when water is being pulled illegally. And that's something hopefully they can relay to us and we can get out and look at it. But we definitely don't want to be losing, I believe what they said in city councils, we were losing 30% of some water along those lines. So it's a pretty big amount and a good amount. And I don't know if it's because of the pipes or somebody's stealing water. So we definitely want to get a handle on that if we can and see where that water's going.
Okay. Sergeant, anything else you want to touch on before we go?
No, I think it's going to be a great activity tomorrow for us, and we'll just keep on enjoying our community and working together with everybody to make Heber as great as we believe it is.
All right, we've been talking to Police Sergeant Josh Weischer of the Heber Police Department. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you for having me. Have a good day.
Facing a 2025 budget shortfall of up to $15 million, Summit County is laying the groundwork for a property tax hike. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports it's a failsafe if voters don't pass a sales tax this November.
County Chief Financial Officer Matt Levitt has estimated next year's budget shortfall could range from $12 to $15 million. He says it can be made up with a new 0.5% sales tax, which the Summit County Council put on the November 5th ballot earlier this summer. The sales tax wouldn't apply to gas, prescriptions, or unprepared foods like groceries, but voters could reject the measure. If they do, county officials say they don't want to be forced to cut services. So the county council and staff are holding preliminary meetings to, quote, preserve the option of seeking more property tax revenue, as Council Chair Melina Stevens put it Wednesday. The process to raise taxes in Utah is called Truth in Taxation, and state law says County Manager Shane Scott has to recommend the process to the council before October 1st. Here's Stevens.
And so that's what happened yesterday. Ultimately, it's a council decision.
Because the county's budget cycle coincides with the calendar year, state law also requires the council to vote in mid-October whether to initiate the process, which is before the November 5th election. If it does begin Truth in Taxation, the council wouldn't make a final decision on taxes until December. Scott also said Wednesday the preliminary budget Levitt will present in October will include the sales tax as its main revenue source, not higher property taxes. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
So Nuzzles & Company has been arranging love affair adoptions between owners and pets for many, many years. Joining us in the studio this morning is the recently appointed executive director of Nuzzles, Leslie Barkas. Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you, Roger, for having me on your program this morning.
So, Leslie, can you give us a little bit about your arc? What is your background? How did you end up at Nuzzles?
I've been coming to Park City, I guess, since about late 2015, so was enamored with the community, which is a beautiful community of dog and cat loving people. So it was a perfect fit for me personally, as well as I have long-term experience, excuse me, in the nonprofit world, working in various nonprofit organizations for about the past 25 years. So it was a great fit.
Okay, and let's talk, many people are sort of aware of, to some extent, of what Nuzzles does, but let's talk a little bit about the full scope of your operation.
Yeah, thank you. As many people know, I mean, it was so exciting this morning to walk in and find Bean, who's a Nuzzles dog right here in our lobby, and Roger told me he has two Nuzzles cats. So obviously we do a lot of rescue of at-risk and homeless animals, which are found predominantly among some of the Navajo and Ute reservations, which are overrun with homeless animals. And so we work with them to rescue animals, do a lot of spay, neuter of those animals as well, but bring them into communities where people are looking to take them into, you know, loving adoptive homes. So we ready the animals for adoption, get them into adoptive homes. But in addition, one of our really important services is our low-cost community clinic, in which we offer affordable spay, neuter, vaccination, and microchipping services. And we also have a Purple Paw program, which is helping people who are, you know, caught up in domestic violence, but they need a safe haven for their pet while they're working out their life. We take in those pets for a period of time until they land in a safe environment.
So let's take a step back. You talk about animals in the reservation area. How do those come to you? How do you find them? And then what process do you go through once they are identified for you?
So we're working with various partners in those communities, such as Red's Rose Rescue, who work in the Navajo out of Shiprock, New Mexico. And so we have various community partners. Sometimes as we go down to do some of our spay and neuter clinics on the reservations, we just bring animals back as well. We're also pulling as well from shelters such as, Heber, Draper, Summit County. So we're working with local shelters as well.
So that's interesting. You will actually take your personnel and go down into the reservation and do spay and neuter clinics. Do you have a staff that includes, obviously, veterinarians?
We do. We have a full medical suite at Nuzzles. So we have veterinary staff, a really excellent medical director, Alyssa Hughes, and a fantastic staff there.
Okay, so many people are familiar with the location that's out at the, what we used to call the outlets, but now has a new name. We also have something called Rescue Ranch. Where is that and what happens there?
Yes, so that's right, Roger. So we have at Junction Commons, which I guess
that's
was
the new name.
Yeah,
thank
formerly
you.
The Outlet Center. We do have an adoption center, as well as the Rescue Ranch, which is a beautiful 16,000-foot facility located in 100 acres out Browns Canyon Road. And a lot of people don't know about the ranch. We aim to get people out there, hopefully more starting this year, for volunteerism and other activities. I mean, we always need volunteers. So we had a great turnout recently during the Park City Day of Service, where we expected, 10 people, and I went into the lobby and saw, 50 sets of eyes staring at me. So it was a really great success.
And how many animals pass through your doors in a given year in terms of adoptions, roughly?
So we're able to rescue and adopt out somewhere between 800 to 1,000 animals annually. And we have saved about 27,000 animals in the nearly 35-year history of Nuzzles.
How big is your annual budget to run an operation like this?
The annual budget is about $1.8 million. Aspirationally, it would be probably $2.2 million. Mm-hmm. The reason, Roger, it is a complex business model, if you will, with two locations. And, of course, we're looking after these animals 24/7. So there are a lot that goes into shelter, rescue, and adoption operations. And so we're always looking, to kind of stabilize and grow. We would like to grow our budget to be able to do more community outreach and also just to, shore up our operations.
So we talked about the output, both in terms of adoptions and in terms of money. Where do you get the money? How do you raise your funds?
So fundraising for rescue and shelter operations is, it's really very much a local endeavor. Shelter operations don't have access really to a lot of, large-scale national grants. There's really not that much either at the state level. So it's very, very much a local initiative. So we depend highly upon our local community. In addition, of course, we work with the likes of Petco Foundation and other generous foundations that might be in Utah or just, friends of Park City who also support us.
Now, I read the new note you put out when you took over. One of the things you talked about was the need for some specific capital projects. Can you talk a little bit about, your needs or your want list right now?
Yeah, well, it's a complex operation, as I said. So some of our space is not as usable as we would love it to be, so we could use some support to get the air conditioning going in parts of the building that were never air conditioned. Additionally, we have a part of our kennel in which the dogs are kept in an area that we called mosh. But we would like to get that kennel into a pod model that we could get the dogs more outside. So the dogs do get outside daily. We have large run areas and we walk them, but there's this part that we would like to move outside that would probably cost us about, I don't know, $125,000 to $140,000 to be able to take on that capital improvement project. Excuse me. So, you know, when we're always in need of vehicles and vans for transport, we put a lot of miles on our vans. And so, you know, our vehicles are always a concern. So honestly, if we had another, you know, $250,000 a year just to take care of our capital maintenance, I'd be delighted.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the specific fundraising activities you have engaged in the past and what you're planning in the future. You had a 5K run, I understand, in July?
We did postpone that because we're actually working with the Summit Land Conservancy and Mountain Trails to configure our trails differently. So we postponed that until next year. So that is one way that we want to get people out to the ranch, and we're excited to do that next spring.
Oh, so you're going to do the run actually out at the ranch?
Yeah, we're going to do it out at the ranch. Okay. Another thing we would like to do that we're pondering is possibly organizing snowshoe walks or hiking visits with dogs at the ranch. You could come and take a dog or maybe even bring your own dog with. And we'd like to tap into, you know, people visiting Park City who maybe need a day off from skiing and want to come out and with their family and do a snowshoe hike.
So, so you're looking at a snowshoe hike. Do you do any kind of annual gala or function like that as well?
We do an annual gala that is, you know, always a great deal of fun and is well attended. So we did that this year in July, and that is one of our core fundraisers. We were really blessed to be given some support from a recent Deer Valley concert with Gregory Allen Isakoff, who made a lovely donation to us. So we were grateful for that. We do a lot of puppy snuggle lounges, which are wildly successful. So we're partnered with the Pendry, the St. Regis, and the Waldorf. And we think Hyatt Deer Valley as well to do some puppy snuggle lounges. And as well, those organizations are supporting us with some of their, I guess, room fees. If people are bringing in pets, then we'll get a percentage of the room fee.
So I have to ask what a puppy snuggle lounge is.
Well, it's the most delightful thing you can imagine because it's snuggling with three or four puppies that we might have rescued from the reservation. You know, we often take in feral mamas who give birth sometimes in the shelter, and then we get the puppies ready for adoption and in between time do snuggle lounges. So we also recently did a snuggle lounge with Def Leppard in Salt Lake City, which was pretty funny.
A snuggle lounge with Def Leppard. That is not, you know, that would not have been on my bingo card. Okay, anything else that we should touch on before we go?
Well, I just want to reiterate how important community support is for shelters. Again, we don't have access to funding at a national level for the most part, or state level. And so we deeply appreciate the love and support that we see from Park City. One of the most delightful things is going everywhere and seeing a Nuzzles dog. It's just so much fun. And as I said, when I came in today, I met Bean, who was a Nuzzles dog. And so it's really spectacular to walk around the city and meet all these dogs that we've rescued over time with the support of our local community.
Okay, thanks for spending time with us.
Thank you again for the opportunity.